May it please the court. James Hardy, attorney number 38173. I'm a public defender and I represent Jason White in this case. I'll limit my remarks to issue one. Unless the court has questions on the other two issues, I'll rest on the briefs on those. Issue one is a straightforward challenge for cause issue involving an expressly actually biased juror who expressed actual bias in favor of police witnesses and the prosecution. I want to emphasize a couple points about that and answer any questions that the court may have. But I do want to address up front that the Attorney General has made some speculative arguments about the state of the record. The state of the record is addressed in great detail in the reply brief, but I want to be clear up front. The record on appeal is complete in this case. Now, as to the juror, who I'll call Juror B as he's referred to in the briefs, from the outset of the case of voir dire, the juror expressed actual unequivocal bias in favor of police witnesses and the prosecution. On his jury questionnaire, in response to a question asking whether there was anything that would prevent him or give him difficulty being fair and impartial in a case, the juror wrote, "all kinds." The prosecutor asked the juror about that written response, and the juror said, "given my many years of experience in law enforcement, I tend to favor you guys, the prosecution, rather than the defense." The prosecutor then, perhaps attempting to draw back, you know, that response, said to the juror, "you don't want to be here today, do you?" And the juror said, "being honest." That was the end of that exchange. And right there we can see demonstrated actual bias. And what's critical here is that...
Well, Mr. Hurley, I'm sorry to interrupt. Let's say, what if that juror did not want to be there? Does that make that juror biased?
Well, I mean, the record we have, Judge Furman, is that when prodded on that point by the prosecutor, the juror said he was simply being honest about the fact that he had predisposed to favor the prosecution.
Well, I understand there's a lot of record support for that position, but didn't the judge at the beginning ask the jurors? Let's see if I can find it here. If selected as a juror, would you be willing to accept the basic principles of criminal law and render a fair and impartial verdict based solely on the evidence presented at trial and the law as I give it to you in my instructions? The record reflects that the jurors answered yes.
True. The judge asked that of the entire room, including, I don't know exactly how many people were in the room, but there's the 26 plus however many were in the back of the room. Essentially to raise their hand if they would have a problem being following the court's instructions. But that's prior to this exchange between the prosecutor and Juror B, in which Juror B quite clearly states that he tended to favor the prosecution rather than the defense. And if you look throughout the entire record, that question by the court is the only time that question is posed, at least in terms of Juror B. Juror B is never asked is never rehabilitated. Juror B is never asked whether he could set aside his personal experience, his personal prejudices. Juror B is never asked whether he could follow the court's instructions. To the extent that the entire room no one in the room raised their hand and said, I'm a biased juror in response to the court's preliminary question, I don't think that's sufficient to rehabilitate the juror in this instance.
Okay, why?
Because there's so much specific evidence after that question of the juror's bias.
And you're not talking about an implied bias, any kind of a relationship with law enforcement. You're only going under actual bias.
Well, I mean, I actually think, and it is in the briefs, I actually think there's a combination of factors here that makes this a particularly troubling case and comes under cases such as People v. Prater, some other cases that have followed the rationale in that case. Because as a matter of fact, the juror did have what he said was approximately 25 close associations, friends and family in law enforcement. He was on a pension from the police department in this case, the Colorado Springs Police Department.
But do you think that's raised here?
I do. I think it's an issue. I believe that this case presents the strongest possible case for actual bias, but I do think...
Well, okay. But let me get the preservation, and then we'll get a little more into the actual bias. But how do you think this is before us properly under an implied bias?
Well, defense counsel's challenge was first that the juror would believe a police officer against another witness in a vacuum, I believe were her words. She also said that she believed that he was biased because he was on a pension from CSPD. Now, I think the law, I'm not conceding the point, but the law tends to say that a retired employee would not be an automatic statutory challenge, but certainly that would factor into a challenge for implied bias if he's still receiving money from the same police department that's involved in this case. Defense counsel fleshed out a very thorough record of the fact that he had these 25 associations, the fact that he still knew many people on the Colorado Springs Police Department, and that he shared camaraderie with them, actually, in the express words were used.
So is it your position that all retired policemen who are on pension and continue to have friends who are policemen are disqualified?
No, that's not my position at all. My position is that this particular juror, given that he expressed actual bias, and we haven't even gotten to all those points, but the juror also said that if a police officer said he saw red and another third-party witness said he saw blue, all things being equal, he would have to believe the police officer. The juror also said that...
You're moving now into an actual bias.
True.
Instead of...
may be my fault, so
no,
I apologize.
No, I agree. My point is that there's a combination of factors.
Well, I understand.
Here.
Okay.
I think that that actual bias is determinative in this case.
All right,
but
let's get into the actual bias then, because the follow-up question that I had, the judge did make the general question at the beginning. Would that in and of itself be enough? Were that asked of this juror at the end of all of this, would that be enough to have rehabilitated this juror?
Well, of course, as you pointed out, that's not this case. But
I understand.
But my view is you probably would need a little bit more than that. You probably would need some specific questioning about whether or not you could set aside. In this case, you would need some
questions about following the instructions. Basic principles of criminal law render a fair and impartial verdict based solely on the evidence as I give it to you in my instructions.
I think when you have a juror who has made it clear that he has a predisposition to favor one side over the other, you need to be a little more specific than simply that question. Again, that's not this case, but okay. In that scenario, if the judge had attempted to rehabilitate this juror, which the judge did not hear,
So what's the discretion that we, I mean, this is a tough case, there's no question. What's the discretion that we have to follow? I mean, what's the standard? It's a discretionary standard, is it not? The judge is sitting there.
True. The judge is sitting there. But the record we have, I mean, the many cases that this court has decided say that really, that what the judge needs to do in a situation such as this is at least additionally question the juror, at least ask the juror whether or not the juror can set aside the personal feelings that he's made clear, and I believe the record is clear on that here. So in the scenario in which the judge doesn't even do that much, I mean, there's also opinions from this court which express that we don't place a ton of confidence in the sort of leading question approach. People v. Merrill, at least in a concurrence, says that, you know, when you get these responses to leading questions, that doesn't give us great faith that the juror has been rehabilitated. But at least that much needs to be attempted. And the juror may say, yes, Your Honor, I can set those things aside. Or the juror may say, no, I won't be able to. And then the judge would probably dismiss it. But in this case, the judge has none of those things.
Okay, now this is all premised on the old McCrander rule, which is before our Supreme Court right now, is it not, on cert?
Absolutely.
So do you think that the McCrander is going to be around?
I mean, the first thing I would say about that, Far be it for me to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do in that case.
All of us.
But, I mean, the first thing I'll say about it is that it still governs this court. It's governing precedent, and many decisions from this court have cited that, saying we're governed by McCrander, or at least the rule expressed in McCrander. Do I believe that McCrander is the proper rule? Yes, I do. I believe that McCrander, under our state constitution, under our statutory law, has been good law for 100 years.
But wasn't McCrander a federal question?
I don't read McCrander that way. I'm not one of the attorneys that's going to be arguing that case to the Supreme Court, so I'm not the most versed in that law. But what I read, the way I read McCrander, from what I do know about it, is that the federal authorities that address that issue don't necessarily govern Colorado state law, and that McCrander expresses a state principle that's been well established in this jurisdiction for 100 plus years. Unless the court has further questions at this point, I think I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You have just under 4 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. Your honors, first of all, I want to withdraw my objection to the record. I've been doing this work for, I have to say, more than 2 decades, and I've never seen written peremptories before. But once I got defense counsel's explanation, and once I asked around to a few of my colleagues, they told me that this, in fact, is a practice and that a court reporter keeps this chart and that it's kosher. So I withdraw my objection. Secondly, regarding this potential juror, I would say that context is very important here in terms of the trial court's decision not to excuse this juror. This court has to review the entire voir dire in determining whether or not the trial court abuses discretion, and therefore I wanted to go into a little bit of the context and background of this, although some of this has already been talked about before I got up here. One is that the veneer was asked those mandatory exemption questions that constitute implied bias from 1610-103, including whether anybody had not only a bias but a feeling for or against the prosecution or the defense, and also whether they could decide this case based on principles of criminal law and render a fair and impartial verdict. Also, I think it's important that Juror B admitted he was trying to get out of jury service. This was a feeling, I don't think it was elicited by the prosecution because he had any particular agenda. I think he looked at all this and may have assumed it was hyperbolic and said, you don't want to be here, do you? And he said, yep, just being honest. So that's what we have. But I think it's pretty clear he was trying to get out of jury service. I think the most important thing about this record in terms of the challenge for cause is when this juror was asked about police officers and memory, do they automatically have better memories? Instead of saying what you would think a biased juror would say, he said, I don't know. And then he thought about it and he said, officers are trained to observe and they're trained to remember, and therefore, when he says he will believe a police officer over a lay witness, therefore, since they're trained to do these things, therefore, he doesn't think they have better memories per se, but he thinks they have training that allows them to testify.
Well, Ms. Pratt, you're reading that explanation into the record. Let me ask you about the trial judge's responsibility.
Okay.
The trial judge is supposed to watch this voir dire carefully and supervise it, is he not?
He is.
And if there was ever a case where the red light should go on, that you need to ask that juror, hey, can you still be fair and impartial isn't this the case where the juror says, I have a tendency to side with you, as opposed to the defense, and then goes on to say, if a law enforcement, the defense counsel asks, if a law enforcement officer that you never met before says the color I saw was red and a lay witness with no law enforcement experience testified that the color he saw was blue, who would you believe? And his answer is, I'd have to go with the police officer. Now, I can't imagine a clearer example of something that should alert the trial judge. This may be a problem, but we have nothing in this record from this judge, no follow-up whatsoever.
I agree that in a perfect world, we would have a lot of findings by the trial court concerning demeanor, concerning sincerity, concerning credibility. I agree it would be wonderful. I probably wouldn't be here doing this if that were the case. I do think that the juror's answer to the memory question does inform that later question about whether he would believe a police officer over a lay witness in the abstract. And in the vacuum.
Let me interrupt you, because I don't think this is in a vacuum. How many years did this prospective juror serve in Colorado Springs as a police officer?
I think a couple of decades, about as long as I've served.
A long time.
A long time.
So these questions are premised on that kind of a background.
Correct.
Now, would you want somebody like this serving on a jury if you were the accused?
Well, I think this is, I'm glad you brought that up. I think this is precisely the reason for a peremptory, not a peremptory challenge. I think that's what these discretionary challenges are all about, to excuse people who have experiences that may not necessarily align with your case.
But we have McCrander that places some additional burden on the judge to ensure due process, fair trial questions.
True. McCrander's a thorn in my side because because my problem with this case especially is that police officer testimony was really not determinative of the outcome here. We had somebody see him take the goods that were stolen. We had somebody help him who testified that he helped them take the goods that were stolen. And we had the landlord testify that he
Irrespective, well, irrespective of all that, the challenge for cause question would be reversible error, irrespective. We're not going to employ a harmless error.
Correct.
At least under the current state of the law.
That's my rant. I'm sorry.
Okay. So my question is, would you want somebody like this serving on a jury where you the accused?
I would probably exercise a peremptory challenge against somebody like this if I were the accused, yes. However, four other potential jurors sat on the jury. They were asked that question about whether or not they would believe, in a vacuum, a police officer over a lay witness, and two of them ended up sitting on the jury. So I don't think that question
was
a deal breaker.
Well, they're not before us, and they didn't serve for 20 years. Police force.
It's background, Your Honor. I'm just talking about the factors that the trial court, I'm defending the trial court's ruling. I'm saying these are things that he may or may not have taken into account. These are things he should have taken into account in making his ruling. I need water, just a minute. The challenge for cause was based on three factors: the pension, the ties to law enforcement, and the statement that we talked about, that he believed a police officer over a lay witness. Concerning the police pension, it's not part of the implied bias that the legislature set forth. And there's case law that says that retired persons are not compensated employees of law enforcement, and therefore they can serve. So the pension, of and by itself, isn't a reason to grant a challenge for cause.
But I think Mr. Hardy is saying that that goes as a factor into the actual bias question.
What the rationale was for current law enforcement not serving, I think I read a case on the background of this, that is that when you come in contact with the same people every day and your livelihood depends on a paycheck from these people, you're likely to be impliedly biased towards this organization, and therefore that's why it's an implied bias. When you're retired, that sort of goes out the window. This gentleman was working at another job. He'd been retired for 12 years. He wasn't even working for law enforcement anymore. And this gentleman was, we don't know if he was coming into daily contact with law enforcement because nobody asked him those questions. Our case is that there's no state of mind here, given the questionnaire and given the answers to the questions that were asked him by defense counsel. We don't really have a state of mind that says he's not going to decide the case impartially. When he was asked a question about police officers' memory, he said, I don't know. A partial person or someone that wasn't going to be impartial would have said, yeah. I mean, they would have been consistent with their questionnaire answers. So I don't think, to answer your question, I don't think that the pension qualifies as implied bias. I think that he was getting his, you get your pension when you're a police officer from the state.
Well, my question was getting at the actual bias, that is a factor that Mr. Hardy is saying goes into the many of the factors that go into the actual bias.
He says yes, I say no. I say that no, it's not, he's not biased, actually, because he gets a pension. He may be biased. Well, I guess the second thing was his law enforcement contact. There may be other reasons why he's biased, but based on the pension or the pension alone, I don't think so. I don't even think it's, I don't really think it's a factor. But the law enforcement could be, because on his questionnaire, he wrote down 25. Well, he was asked why he wrote down 25, and he said, well, I just put down that number because I have a lot of contacts in law enforcement. They're numerous. Nobody asked him 5, more than 20, more than 50, more than 200. We don't know on this record. It would seem to me that the person whose responsibility it is to support the challenge for cause, it would seem to me that somebody would try to establish a record regarding exactly how many contacts he has. Plus,
well, he said 25, didn't he?
Well, I think he said 25, but then he indicated that they were numerous. He said, I don't know, you know, I just wrote that down, I think is what he was trying to say.
Well, and it's clear there were a lot,
he said. It's clear there were a lot, but
well,
we
that's
don't know.
More than a few.
It's more than a few, but are they daily contacts? Are they Christmas cards once a year? Do we see them at the National Police Academy reunions every 25 years? I don't know. Nobody asked. And remember, this was in a context where he was saying they might be somewhat hyperbolic, I don't know, but he indicated he didn't want to serve on the jury. So we don't know. This is the mix that the trial court had to consider. Also, I don't know if law enforcement contacts of and by themselves, I mean, the case law says of and by themselves, they really don't mandate disqualification. Since he's also a police officer himself, usually law enforcement contacts go to the influence they have on that person. So what's really probably relevant here is the influence that the officer's training and background had on this person. And nobody asked him those questions. I think in the first instance, before the judge starts rehabilitative questioning, he has to show a state of mind, given the entire record, not just his questionnaire, that he couldn't decide the case, that he would be impartial, that he could not be impartial. And I don't think that his responses, I don't think enough was elicited from him that we have that threshold, which is the statutory threshold. I think I've talked about the law enforcement's testimony over that of a lay witness. I'd say the standard of review for a challenge for cause is an abuse of discretion, which gives a wide berth to the trial court, particularly where a juror is trying to get out of jury service, and the eyes and the ears of you, the trial court has to be your eyes and your ears. He assesses the credibility, the demeanor, and the sincerity of this former officer.
Well, what is the significance of that initial questioning by the judge to the whole group?
I think it's a lot, because I think that in what he says first off, I mean, I have the record, but what I recall he said was, if you say yes to any of these questions, this will excuse you from jury service. So we're sort of opening the door and saying, you know, here's the exit if you want to go. And this juror didn't say anything. I think it's significant. I think here there has to be enough evidence from Merrow to compel the inference that the juror cannot decide a crucial issue fairly. When there is not that evidence on this record, this court should defer to the trial court's ruling. And for this reason, the people would respectfully request that the defendant's convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
I think my colleague just made an interesting point there, actually. You know, when the judge asked that initial question about, are any of you in this room unable to perform jury service, are unable to be impartial, and that being the point at which the jurors could have raised their hand and gotten out of jury service, it kind of conflicts with the whole concept that that juror B was a juror who was simply attempting to get out of jury service in this case, and tends to support the fact that when he's questioned specifically about what he put on his jury questionnaire, that he was being honest, as he said, about his tendency to favor the defense and the prosecution.
But he never said that he wanted to get out of jury service. What he said was, I have a tendency to side with you as opposed to the defense, and the prosecutor said, excellent, you don't want to be here, do you? And the juror didn't say, no, I don't want to be here. The juror said, I'm being honest.
Exactly. I don't see any evidence on this record that the juror was trying to get out of jury service. I believe this record 100% supports the fact that the juror was simply being honest about his predisposition to favor police witnesses and the prosecution. And that demonstrates actual bias, and all these other associations that we're talking about just backs up the reasons for his actual bias. I mean, the fact that there are understandable reasons that he might favor police witnesses, given that he was a police officer for 20 to 25 years, doesn't change the fact that that's an expression of bias. And that, as a defendant, you wouldn't want to have that juror on your panel. And in fact, in this case, the defendant had a right to have that juror struck from the panel for cause based on his expressed actual bias and nothing to rehabilitate that bias. And I just wanted to make clear, in terms of my position, I think this court can decide on actual bias alone, but there is a whole line of cases, as recently as 2011, a case called People v. Roldan. All these are in the briefs. I mean, I can provide citations if you would like, but People v. Roldan in 2011, People v. Prater from 1992, People v. Rogers from 1984, all those are from this court, and then the Supreme Court and People v. Reddick in 1980 cited a combination of factors, both expressed and implied, based on associations that a juror had with law enforcement and lack of rehabilitative information to reverse a conviction under circumstances much like this one. And then just to clarify on the record, the juror on the jury questionnaire did write 25 friends and family in law enforcement. And when he was questioned about it, he said, well, I just put that because there were only two lines there, and two lines weren't enough to list all the people I'm associated with. And then he said he had friends both in Colorado and New York, friends and family in law enforcement, including, I think this occurred later on with defense counsel, but including current members of CSPD. And unless the court has further questions, I would simply ask that the court reverse Mr. White's conviction and remand the case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.